The Authentic Success Podcast is brought to you by The Natural Professional, dedicated to supporting you in kicking ass without kicking your own ass. At naturalprofessional.com, get inspiration, tools, and skills through group and one-on-one coaching, courses, articles, video tutorials, and more. I'm Sean Tuttle, Chief Sauerkraut Maker here at The Natural Professional. In this episode, I'm talking with Irene Au, Head of User Experience at Google. Seeing as the small business owner can get caught up in what they need to do to make their business work, all the marketing, etc., we, I'm one of them, can have a tough time looking at our work through the eyes of our clients or customers. That's why I wanted to talk with Irene. Let's start with your background a little bit. So you're the head of user experience at Google, and what brought you there?
I had been the head of user experience at Yahoo before.
Okay.
And, the opportunity to do this at Google and have a similar role was really just too good to pass up, because even though it was very much similar to the role that I had played at Yahoo, it was an opportunity to just do this in an environment that was so culturally different from Yahoo in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It was very engineering driven and, you know, just this passion for ideas and thinking big and doing crazy things to, you know, bring the internet to users and use it, technology to make people's lives better. It was very much in line with kind of what I wanted to make my life's work about. And in the end, I was just so curious about Google.
Yeah.
I wanted to be on the inside.
Right. Yeah, it is an amazing phenomenon that I can so see the appeal of that. I understand that in college, you started out in engineering and then you moved to computer interaction and engineering psychology. Is that right?
Yeah, it was human-computer interaction.
Okay.
Engineering psychology. Yeah. So my original intention was to get a PhD in electrical and computer engineering. That was what I had studied as an undergraduate. And I just had always been fascinated by technology and loved computers and loved gadgets and things like that. But I felt like I was not a kindred spirit to the rest of my peers there, who really seemed to love technology for the sake of technology. And I was much more interested in how to make technology useful for people and how it fit into people's lives and the things that it could enable people to do. Just coincidentally, I had also discovered this field of engineering psychology and human factors. I just cobbled together my own program of study, looking at engineering psychology and human factors, and also computer science and industrial engineering, and kind of put together my own program of study. Now, these days, you can major in human-computer interaction. There are a lot of great universities that offer that as a major, but when I was going through school, that wasn't commonly the case. And so I just kind of followed my passion and kind of created my own field of study at that time.
The intersection of psychology and, well, in your case, engineering, but also business is so incredibly fascinating, in part because there's this tendency, it seems like, in the business world to look at things from a very logistical and nuts and bolts type of perspective, when in fact, the human factor in all of this is such a huge part of it. So I was wondering if we could use that as a bit of a transition to this user experience field that you are now in.
Mm-hmm. Well, we often describe this world of user experience design as part of a three-legged stool, where the human side, as you described, is one of the three legs, and certainly the technical capabilities or the engineering side is another leg. And the third leg really being the market opportunity and the business opportunity. So you really need all three to create a viable business and a viable product. You know, there has to be a need in the market for it, and it has to be technically feasible, and it also needs to be something that people want. And that's really what I see the whole kind of area of user experience and design of being is to make products that are useful and usable and desirable by your target audience.
How do you start unearthing some of that information. And I guess it from the human side, mm-hmm. the what people want, mm-hmm. So that you can then match it up mm-hmm. with what's possible.
Yeah, and this is where the methods that you that we draw from the field of psychology come in really handy. And in fact, a lot of people in my field have a background in cognitive psychology because it is really looking at understanding how people behave and what their motivations are. And there's kind of a feed-forward feedback process where sometimes new product innovation or new feature development or improvements over existing products can be inspired by an understanding of how people are using the current product, or if there is no product that exists, it can be inspired by an understanding of people's latent needs. And it really goes deeper than just asking people, like, well, what do you want? Because people don't know what they don't know. If you ask people, like, do you want an iPad? Like, people will be like, oh, no, I don't want a big iPhone.
Right.
So it's really looking at, it's often inspired by looking at, like, how are people behaving? And how, like, what is the opportunity for making people's lives better? So we often use field research methods that are inspired by anthropology, you know, like using ethnography to watch people in their natural settings and look at where the pain points are, look at those latent needs. And then that often serves as stimulus in our brainstorming process to kind of look at, okay, well, given these needs and also what the technology is capable of doing, what kind of offering could we, you know, potentially create that might be something that people want? And then once you have prototypes developed or a product that's launched, then there's the feedback part of the process where you watch people use your product and taking a look at how the product's actually used, you can then use that to refine the product or to expand or you know, do another iteration of feature improvements or innovation on top of that. So there's kind of a feed forward and a feedback process that takes place.
So I'd love to know a little bit more about how the cognitive psychology comes into the observations. So just to tie it back to small business owners who very much should be paying attention to what their clients' needs are, although we mm-hmm. tend to get very stuck in our own technical capabilities, both what we want to mm-hmm. produce and what we're able to produce, but pulling in that mm-hmm. other part of what they need and then also understanding that what people need isn't necessarily what they think they need. So I really understand mm-hmm. that there's a lot of psychology in there. So I'm wondering if you could go into a little more depth into the psychology aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at the heart of it, it's really about behavioral observation. So we don't do focus groups, you know, because what people say they do versus what they actually do can often be different. And then also, sometimes people are just not really conscious about the decisions that they make or the things that they do. They just kind of take things for granted. So it's sometimes hard to get people to articulate what they're needs are, because at the heart of it, we're looking for these latent needs that just often go unexpressed except through behaviors. You know, the reason why people who are in this field often come from a background in cognitive psychology is because they are familiar with and know how to employ research methods to understanding human behavior. Mm. And the output of that research is what kind of serves as a stimulus for these brainstorms that we do. So, you know, like when we study people in the usability lab or when we go out into the field, there's a whole protocol. I mean, we have to design a study. And it's not necessarily quantitatively scientific. I mean, sometimes it could be only 8 users. And so, you know, one of the criticisms that we might get is like, oh, well, how do you know it's statistically valid? It's only 8 users. But really, it's really going for qualitative feedback. You're looking at how people are using the site, and you'd be surprised at just looking at 8 users, you could start to see consistencies. You could start to get insights into, like, where is the product confusing or where are people, you know, struggling with the product or the offering. Maybe they don't understand what the value proposition is or they don't know how to move through the site. It can range, you know, in a number of different ways. And just by watching a few people use the product or living their lives, you can get a lot of insight into what the opportunities are.
What you're really doing is building experiences, not products.
Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the product that is the ultimate goal, but the ultimate goal is to make people's lives better. Let me just think of what a very straightforward example might be. Like some websites measure their success based on time spent, for example. And they think that like, oh, if I have a lot of people spending a lot of time on my site, that must mean that it's a very useful site and that it's very popular. Well, that's not necessarily the case. It could be that they're spending a lot of time on your site because it's hard to find stuff, or that they have to click through a number of pages in order to get to the information that they're looking for. So it can be misleading. So if you think of your offering in terms of an experience, you want to think of it not in terms of like time spent or how many pages are viewed, but really like, was it a gratifying, rewarding experience? Was it an experience that wasn't frustrating for people? Did they feel satisfied and fulfilled? Do they feel delighted? Do they feel productive? Are they left feeling awesome? So maybe that just means that it's not about time spent. Maybe the goal is to get people in and out of the site as quickly as possible because they're just looking for information. People are left with a feeling after they interact with your company or your product. And you, at the end of the day, I mean, it's like a yoga class. In yoga training, like we're often told, like, you know, what really matters is how people feel at the beginning of the class and at the end of the class. And what happens in the middle, it's like, you know, okay, it's, you know, maybe there can be some fumbles. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, if people feel like they were able to accomplish what they wanted to do, you make them feel awesome, then they're going to have a great experience. I don't know if that analogy holds. I've never tried that before. I think it's pretty good.
right. Okay, so since you brought up yoga, I would love to go into that realm. So if fundamentally, so my business being the natural professional, and fundamentally what I see that as being is this kind of merging of the inner and the outer. So honoring the inner experience while kicking butt, you know, externally out in the world. And one way of looking at that is, you know, that intersection between process and product. So in one of your recent blog posts on your personal blog, I saw that you wrote about non-attachment. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about that. Maybe in your own words, explain what you see non-attachment as meaning.
Okay. First of all, I have to say, I love what you're trying to convey, like with you know, the natural professional. Like I completely am 100% aligned. You know, I think like at heart, people should pursue what gives them joy and what gives them energy and what they're passionate about. And so I think that's great that you are kind of advocating for that and advocating for how people can be true to themselves and have that be what their life's work is. And, you know, I think related to the non-attachment piece, it's kind of like, when you're intrinsically motivated to do something because, and you're going to be intrinsically motivated because it gives you joy, because you feel passion around it. When you're intrinsically motivated to do something, it's the kind of experience that doesn't matter what the outcome is because you just love doing it. And that's kind of what, I think that's kind of the role that non-attachment has here, is that it's not the end. You know, you want to have a good outcome, but you're not doing it because you want to have a good outcome. You're doing it because you love the act of making, or you love the act of doing whatever it is that you're doing. You know, maybe you love to dance. It's like what's motivating you is not to create an awesome dance or an awesome choreography or whatever, but it's really because you just love to dance. And then because you love to dance, as a result, you're going to dance beautifully. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of, to me, that's kind of the role that non-attachment plays, like as it relates to, you know, what you do professionally. At heart, it has to be an activity that you just love to do. And then because it's an activity that you love to do, you're not necessarily doing it for the sake of the outcome. You're doing it because you just love doing it. And I have this quote, so I have a different intention for every class that I teach in yoga, of course. And at the end of class, I close with a quote. And today's class that I taught was about working joyfully. And the quote that I shared with the class is by James Allen. And the quote is, "Work joyfully and peacefully, knowing that right thoughts and right efforts will inevitably bring about right results." I think that's very true to kind of the question that you're posing to me. Like, if you are intrinsically motivated, and you're doing what you're doing for the right reasons, which is that you're doing it because you love the work and you're not attached to any particular outcome, what will result should be great results.
Right.
because you're doing it for all the right reasons.
Yeah. So being in a potentially high pressure environment with the need to produce, do you feel like that ever gets compromised?
There are always going to be constraints. And I think that constraints actually force you to create better work because it forces you to deliver and it forces you to be inventive and creative. If you had no constraints, you know, a project could linger on forever. It could go nowhere. You could continue dreaming on forever and coming up with crazy stuff that, you know, never gets built. The real pressures of being in a corporation and having to launch stuff and that real people are going to use and is a wonderful gift. The best thing that you can do is just to do the best that you can with the constraints that you have. And it's going to require trade-offs and things like that, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a forcing function.
So as I was asking that question, and based on what you just said, it sounds like one of the really key factors for success here at that level is hiring properly and making sure that the people that come into the job that they are going to do are loving what they're doing and that they're ending up in the right place to start with.
Absolutely.
My final part that I'm curious about that I would love to ask you about is around your daily productivity. Obviously, you teach yoga. You've got this huge role and responsibility at Google. Teach, you practice, your mom, your wife. How do you weave all this together and stay healthy and happy and sane?
That's a very good question. I think the yoga keeps me sane. You know, it's funny. Like, I think if you ever look at like all these commitments and responsibilities as like, oh, another thing you have to do, like, oh my gosh, I have to make time for yoga. You know, like that's never a successful way to approach life.
Right.
And for me, I just want to make sure I fill every minute of my day with something I love to do. That gives me joy and energy. So my kids give me joy and energy. My work brings me a lot of joy. Yoga keeps me sane, and I get a lot of joy out of that too. So I make time for all those things because I want to be doing those things. So I have to be very disciplined about how I spend my time and choosing very carefully, like being around people that will give me energy, doing like engaging in activities that will give me energy. And I have to be ruthless about not engaging in things that are going to drain my energy and passion, you know, and sometimes you have to go to the dentist. Okay.
Right.
But, and you know, I think having like a really good focus around what gives you energy and joy, and then organizing your life around those things is really important because we all have limited hours. And then just in terms of real practical matters, I mean, it does require a lot of sacrifices and trade-offs. So in order to maintain my practice, I teach at 7 a.m. and I practice at 7 a.m., which often means that I have to be up by 6 a.m. or earlier sometimes. And then it means that I have to go to bed earlier, which means that I don't get to stay up and watch, you know, TV or things like that.
Right.
So, you know, there's just trade-offs that you have to make, but they're going to be the right trade-offs if the activities that you're engaging in are what gives you joy.
Nice. Okay, so you've got your inner navigational compass is pointed to joy.
Yeah, very much so.
Awesome.
Yeah. What else is the point of life then, you know?
Well, shoot. I mean, if more people were focused in on what they wanted their fundamental experience of life to be and organize their life around that, you know, I'd be closer to being out of a job and that would be great.
Well, you know, the other thing that I think is really interesting is, you know, not everybody can have the dream job. Like sometimes you do have to just pay the bills and engage in active, you know, and have a job that's maybe a stepping stone to something else that's greater. And you have to consider it's not like what you're doing, but it's how you're doing it. And finding something about the activities that you're engaging in, even if it's not where you want to be, but finding something about that that you really love and can hold on to, like that there's something there, there's like a higher calling that will inspire you just to go through that, you know, and that's also tying it back to yoga. It's kind of like when you start a yoga practice and sometimes the teacher says, choose like an intention that's going to inspire you and motivate you, you know, it's kind of the same thing.
You being in a place in your life where, you know, if we're going to talk about this kind of sweet spot between the inner and the outer, it sounds like you have really found your place in that, as far as having that inner guidance of joy and then expressing that in a lot of different successful ways out in the world. So kudos to you, rockin'.
I don't know. I can't say that anybody has it all figured out. It's a constant process, right?
I totally agree. Totally agree. It's a constant process. And, you know, it's something that we usually need to be reminded of over and over again, especially when we're having a rough day or something challenging comes up and we kind of forget that. And I do think that most people have sort of an overarching motivation that propels them. And that's going to be a lot more telling about where you end up than those occasional, like, oh my God, what am I doing? And I feel like throwing in the towel. So anyway, I love your inner navigational focus there. That's fantastic. Yeah. So are there any other points or just thoughts that you would like to leave readers or readers? How about listeners that you'd like to leave listeners with?
I think if I were to reflect on the conversation that we're having right now, and you know, if there's an overarching theme, it really is to do what you love. And if you're not doing what you love, find something about what you're doing that you do love and focus on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for playing with me all over the map. I know it was sort of an all over the map kind of conversation. So I appreciate you're going with the flow on that.
Sure. And yeah, it's fun.
Right on. Great. Links for this episode can be found on the website. Go to naturalprofessional.com/show notes. All one word, show notes. If you like what you hear in this podcast, one of the kindest ways you can show your appreciation is by leaving a review and a rating on the podcast page in iTunes. This is Sean Tuttle signing off with the reminder that the era of struggle is over.